Welcome to Keeping It Real with Frankie D, the very first Italian-American podcast and the home of the Italian-American moment. I am your very proud host, Frankie D, and we can be heard at ItalianAmericanLife.com, on iTunes, Stitcher, your podcast app. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, connect with us on LinkedIn, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. My guest today is former Chicago Cub baseball player, Carmen Fanzone. Carmen, welcome to the show, and it's really an honor to have you here with us today.
Well, it's an honor for me, too. Thank you, Frank.
Well, this is, you know, when you played with the Cubs, was the early 70s, and I was, about the ages of 6, 7, 8, I was a huge sports fan. We were from the North Side, so we were huge Cub fans, and I was a huge Italian fan. So I was a big fan of yours, and I remember vividly coming home from school, WGN Channel 9. We were very fortunate. They, like, televised every baseball game of the Cubs. So when I would get home from school, it'd be the end of the game, and it was just a great thrill. I used to love it. And before we get into the baseball, tell me a little bit about your Italian family background.
Well, my father was born in Sicily. Palermo, I think. And my mother was born outside of Naples. But they were very young when they came over to the United States. My dad went back for a couple of years and went to school, but then came back here. So, but they were very young, but I'm first generation.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Detroit, Michigan.
Was it a heavily populated Italian area where you grew up?
Not especially. It was a little bit of everything. But my parents started in Pennsylvania. So they must have had relatives or friends in Pennsylvania. They started there. My oldest sister, who was 10 years older than me, who's deceased, she was born in Pennsylvania. And while there, my dad got a chance to get a job at Ford Motor Company in Detroit as a tool and die maker. So that's how we moved to Detroit. And my other sister, Emily, who's 4 years older than me, she was born in Detroit, and I was born in Detroit also.
Okay, I get it.
That's where I grew up.
So I assume you were a big baseball player in high school.
Yeah, I played baseball, and even then, I went to a high school that I majored in music in high school. It's Cass Technical High School, and there's a comparable school in Chicago. Lane Tech is the same way, where they have curriculums that you can major in high school. So I majored in music in high school, but of course I played baseball also.
And then were you drafted out of high school?
Well, I was scouted out of high school, but it was before the draft. So I went to college. I started at Ferris Institute, which now has become Ferris State University. And I went there for a little over a year, and then I transferred to Central Michigan University, and that's where I graduated from.
Still playing baseball, though.
Still playing baseball. Excuse me, I got signed after my senior year at Central Michigan, which was 63. I signed in 64, the year before the draft. They didn't start the draft until 65.
So they would just send scouts to different places.
They had bird dogs that helped out the scouts, and they had scouts everywhere. And starting in high school, I guess people were watching me off and on. And when it came to be, Boston and Pittsburgh were the only two clubs that had any interest in me. And it ended up that Pittsburgh didn't offer me a contract and Boston did. So in 1964, I signed with Boston.
And were you always an infielder?
Yeah. I was really a shortstop on the sandlots, but I knew that if I was to go any further, that my best position would be third base.
So you were signed by Boston Red Sox. You spent some years in their minor league system. I know that you have quite a story about the famous Ted Williams, if you could tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Ted Williams and I share the same birthday, which I found out later on. But of course, anybody that played baseball, Ted Williams was an idol of theirs. You know, he was, he always wanted to be known as the greatest hitter that ever lived. And I think he came pretty close to that. But the spring of 68, we were having spring training in DeLand or in Ocala, Florida. And for some reason, early on in the week that he was there, he was standing behind the batting cage and saw me take some swings. He said, have you always hit that way? And I said, yeah, basically, yeah. He said, you're not moving your hands at all. You're not getting your hands started before you swing. He just, you know, demonstrated a little bit. And then I started to think about that in the batting cage. And instantly, the ball started jumping off my bat. It was pretty amazing. So that for that whole week, Ted Williams watched everything I did. You know, he'd hit ground balls to me at first base, and everything I did, he was watching me. And it was so inspiring, you know, because early on in the minor leagues, we used to kid about being a suspect or a prospect. And we were, you know, if there was only like about three or four prospects on each team, and the rest of us, which we considered suspects, we just made up the rest of the team and didn't get much notice. But
can I ask you, did they have in those days, like they do today, single A ball, double A ball, triple A ball? So there was today, there's a huge amount of minor leaguers. Whereas we're talking about, I think you said the late 60s. Did they have that many minor league teams and that? Those levels, single A, double A, triple A back then?
Oh, sure. They had just, I think a couple of years before that I signed, they used to have B leagues, C leagues, B leagues, A leagues. But when I signed, they had put all the D, C, and B together. So it was all Class A. And they had different levels of Class A. They had a rookie league, and they had guys that had played maybe a couple of years. But it was basically Class A, Double A, Triple A, and then the big leagues. So that was the.
So at this time, when you got this advice from Ted Williams, were you in Triple A at that time?
Oh, I was in A ball.
Oh, you were in A ball.
In fact. No, that was Pittsfield. That was Double A. So I was in Double A at that point. And I had spent my first 2 years in Wellsville, which was an A league, and in Winston-Salem, which was also an A league, but it was a more advanced A league. It was the Carolina League. So in 1966, 7, and 8, I spent in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which was Boston's Double A league or Double A team in the Eastern League. So in 68, I was in camp with Pittsfield, and coincidentally, and maybe not, I went on to be the player of the year that year in Pittsfield. And I think it had a lot to do with the fact that Ted Williams had spent some time with me in spring training and really gave me more confidence.
That's truly amazing, because I mean, you know, I don't know a lot about baseball, but it's pretty much the consensus. This is pretty much the greatest hitter of all time. I mean, that's a huge statement. And for him to affect you in such a positive way with your hitting, I mean, that really is an incredible story. So you play with Boston Red Sox, and then you're traded to
Chicago. It's, you know, I played about 7 years with Boston, and they brought me up to the big leagues in 1970 for a couple months. And then I went back to Louisville at the end of the year. And then I decided I wanted to try to improve my game. And I played winter ball in the Dominican Republic in 1970. And I found out while playing down there that I got traded from Boston to Chicago. So that was, and then of course, 71 was my first year with the Cubs. And I spent that in Tacoma, which was a AAA team. And I got brought up the last month of that season. And I spent the 72, 73 and 74 seasons with the Cubs in the big leagues.
Is it a true story that your debut with the Chicago Cubs, was it the very first pitch you faced, you hit a home run?
Not the first pitch, but my first at bat.
Your first at bat.
In Pittsburgh, we were, I had, that was after the AAA season ended, and I asked the farm director at that point if I could go home to Detroit and get my car and drive to Chicago. He said, sure. So I did that. On the way to Chicago, I got lost. I didn't make it to the airport on time. I missed my flight. And I was supposed to join the team in Pittsburgh that night. So I called, and Blake Cullen was the general or the traveling secretary at that point. And I said, Blake, I said, I missed my flight. Do you still want me to come? He said, grab the next available flight because Ron Santo's not feeling well. Leo may need you in some capacity. So I took the next flight. I didn't get to Pittsburgh until 8 o'clock that night. By the time I got a cab and got to the ballpark and got a uniform, I think it was like the third or fourth inning before I even got to the bench.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because I was so tired. It had been such a long day. And it was a very hot day. I had a 67 Chevy that didn't have air conditioning. I was whipped. I was just so tired. So I sat there in Pittsburgh. That was the year that they won the world championship, 1971. So I sat there and we were getting beat pretty bad, 8-0, 9-0. Milt Pappas was pitching for us. About the eighth, I guess the eighth or ninth inning, Leo looks down the bench and points to me and says, hey, you grab a bat. At that point, he didn't even know who I was.
Oh, my gosh.
So I grab a bat. And again, I'm so physically tired that I didn't think so much about, you know, being nervous or this is my first at bat. Anyway, I'm facing Steve Blass, who ended up winning two games in the World Series that year. So I go up and the first pitch he throws me a slider for a strike. The second pitch, he throws me a fastball. I swing. I hit the ball to left field. And I'm running to first base thinking, well, at least I didn't embarrass myself. Around first base, and I'm looking up, and Willie Stargell, I think, is playing left, and Gene Kline is the center fielder. And they converge on the fence, and the ball goes over the fence. So I had hit a home run my first at bat, and I get to home plate, and I think Don Kessinger was the next hitter. And, of course, he congratulated me and he knew what I had done. But when you're getting beat 8 or 9-0 in the big leagues, you can't jump up and down. You know, so I had to kind of like contain myself. And I sat on the bench knowing that I had done all I could do. But so it was a pretty momentous.
A bittersweet moment.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but what a great start. Speaking of Milt Pappas. So it was a very somewhat famous game. September 2nd, 1972. He's pitching. He has a perfect game going into the ninth inning. And if I am correct with this information, there's two outs. So now the guy's one out from a perfect game. You are playing second base at the time.
Right.
Okay. So he had on the next batter, I believe, a 1-2 count. And he proceeds to throw three balls. And I believe that like two of them at least were very close. Did you have like a playing second base? Did you have a better viewpoint?
Oh, sure. You know, they were balls, but I've seen worse pitches called strikes. And then when you get to two outs in the ninth inning and somebody's pitching a perfect game, at that point, the umpire should have told the hitter, if this ball is not on the back screen, you better swing. You know, just the fact that, you know, there's not going to be any borderline calls. But Bruce Fleming was the umpire at that point. I think that was his rookie year, and he went on to umpire for a lot of years. But he was cantankerous. He was very cantankerous. But Larry Stahl was the hitter, and it was 3-2, and the pitch was borderline. It was a ball, but like I said, I've seen worse pitches called strikes.
Yeah, it just seems. I mean, it seems like he kind of got screwed out of a perfect game because
it gets so close, and they should have given the advantage to the pitcher at that point. You know,
yes.
He got 26 outs, and anyway, he didn't, and Larry Stahl
very
walked.
Upset.
Gary Jestad was the next hitter, and all I was praying for is that it wasn't a ground ball to me. I didn't want any mishaps by me messing up the no-hitter.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. So now, you're a big league player, but this is a very pressureful situation with what was on the line. And since it was a perfect game, which those don't happen very often in the major leagues. No-hitters is a tremendous accomplishment, but they happen. Perfect games are very far and few in between. So did you feel added pressure when you went out there in the sixth inning, the seventh inning, the eighth inning, the ninth inning as an infielder? Did you feel added pressure like, oh, my God, this guy's got a perfect game on the line?
Well, a little bit. I don't think until the ninth inning where I really felt
focusing
more
on it.
The other innings, you know, it's just a no-hitter is a wonderful accomplishment. Perfect game again is perfection.
It's
and you
perfection.
Have to, you know, you have to be good, and you have to be lucky too. You know, there's always a luck involved. You know, a hitter hits a ball right on the nose, but happens to hit it right at somebody, then you got lucky.
Absolutely.
You know,
so now the two outs, the guy walks, and the final out is hit to you. I believe it was a
pop up.
And you made the final out to get to the winner.
I was so glad that it was in the air, that I didn't have to field a ground ball.
And you know, a question that comes to my mind, the batters that are coming up to bat in that ninth inning, the Pittsburgh batters, is, okay, they're professionals. So they want to break this perfect game.
We're playing San Diego, by the way.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, not Pittsburgh, San Diego. I'm sorry. Do they want to break it up? They don't want to, you know, be the team that got a perfect game thrown against them. Do they go up there with the attitude though that they want to swing, or are they trying to get this walk to break up a perfect game?
No, I don't think you ever want to break up a perfect game with a walk. I mean, but everybody is very competitive. Everybody's doing the best they can, and of course they don't want to, you know, they don't want to make an out. Everybody wants to succeed. So. But getting a walk is not in anybody's back of their mind.
Right. Okay. So that's what makes me like, not only was the umpire, and maybe being that you tell me he was a rookie umpire, I don't know. Maybe he just was trying to be tough and say, these are the rules. And he was 2 inches off the strike zone. It's a ball. But also the batter, you would think that the batter with those 1-2 count and, you know, if my memory serves me, I thought there were like two of the three pitches were relatively close. You would think he would have swung at him.
Exactly. You just never know. You never know.
Yeah, it was a shame that the guy lost the perfect game. No hitter is a great accomplishment, but it just was a shame. I did not know you said you actually studied music. I know that you were an accomplished horn player. That's correct.
Right. I was a trumpet player, and not only did I major in music in high school, I majored in music at college also.
Oh, wow. See, I did not know any of that. And I know that you, that same year in 72, in June, you played the Star Spangled Banner at Wrigley Field prior to a game.
Right. Well, it turned out that there was a gentleman that took a liking to me. He was kind of like a PR guy, but he got me associated with LeBlanc Music Company in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So they had just presented me with a new trumpet, a LeBlanc trumpet. So he arranged this, me playing the national anthem with the orchestra from, I'm trying to think, I always used to, the Empire Room. And I used to know the leader of that group, and now it escapes me. I can't think of it. But anyway, it was the orchestra from the Empire Room backed me up on the field. Turns out it was June 18th, 1972. It turns out that that's my wife's birthday, June 18th. I hadn't even met her yet, but she was born, and it also was Father's Day that day. We were playing the Dodgers, and she not only was born on June 18th, but she was born on Father's Day, which occurs only once every 7 or 8 years. So there was a lot of coincidences that happened that day that made it even more special.
Wow, well, that's great. And tell me a little bit about post baseball. I know you went into the music industry. If you could tell me a little bit about that.
Well, when I knew that, or I wanted, when my baseball career was over, and I never really wanted it to end, but everything comes to an end, but I knew that being a trumpet player and being a musician, I knew that I either had to go to New York or Los Angeles just to test the waters, just to see if I could compete musically. I could have stayed in Chicago, and they did a lot of commercials and stuff, but it was limited. You know, there wasn't as much work as there was in New York and in Los Angeles. So my last year in baseball, after I got released by the Cubs in 74, I went to Hawaii in 75 to pursue my career, my baseball career. And I was hoping that I could get off to a good start and possibly get called up back to the big leagues, which it didn't happen because I went to Hawaii about the first month of the season. I slid while I was playing in Tacoma, and I broke my ankle. And it turned out that that was the end of my career. I dislocated my ankle, even though the next spring I tried to resume it in Hawaii again, but I got released and it just didn't happen. But while I was in Hawaii, I had met a couple of trumpet players that had been through the LA recording scene. And they convinced me that I should come here in LA instead of New York, which that's what I did, and I'm glad I did, because I never really got entrenched in the recording field here in LA. But I met my wife, and it turned out okay. And I ended up doing a few things musically, but not enough to support myself. And then I got a job with the Musicians Union as a business rep, and I was there for 29 years. And I retired from them about 4 years ago. So it turned out okay.
And your wife is in the music industry as well, and I believe I saw where she sang a baseball song,
Yes,
correct?
she recorded Dodger Blue, and she recorded Van Lingo Mungo, which is Van Lingo Mungo is a who was a former pitcher with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And so Dave Frischberg, a very talented musician in his own right, but he wrote Van Lingo Mungo. And all the lyrics of the song are all baseball players. And with prodding from the Dodgers, he also wrote Dodger Blue, which is all lyrics are Dodger players, former Dodger players. But my wife, Sue Rainey, has not only did that, but she's been nominated for 4 Grammys. So I was a big fan of hers. You know, she's pretty special. And
How
I've
long have
played
you been
on
married?
almost 40 years.
Wow, well, that's great. Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Carmen, thank you so much for the interview. It was a real pleasure talking to you. Like I say, I was a big fan of my childhood, was Carmen Fanzone for the Cubs. My
Oh, thank you.
hometown, fellow Italian American, I just loved it. So this was a thrill. I really appreciate it.
Frank, my pleasure, and it's a great talking to you, and I feel like I made a trip to Chicago today.
Well, thank you. All the best. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.